And let's get down to business today. With the most confusing, most misunderstood book in all of the Bible, it falls at the end of the Bible, Revelation. All right, now, if you were not here last week for the beginning of our sermon series, this is part two. All right, we hit part one last week on Memorial Day weekend, and I know a lot of you weren't, and I know a lot of you didn't even tune in online, and I know a lot of you didn't get on the podcast app or on Facebook Live or on our regular Northeast app or on our website and watch it over the last 7 days. It's literally impossible to miss a sermon or a service if you don't want to, all right? Not trying to guilt you or anything, but I know a lot of you didn't because you were busy. I get it, you were busy. So if you didn't catch it, you got to go back and catch it, because what's unique about this series is that this isn't five sermons over the course of 5 weeks. It's one sermon stretched out over the course of 5 weeks. And especially last week, if you miss what we, like the content that we covered there, you're going to have a hard time understanding where we're coming from with the rest of the series. Because last week, we spent more time talking about what Revelation isn't than what it is. And I'll go ahead and tell you what it isn't. It isn't some sort of mysterious code that was written to the 21st century. Even though that might be what you hear, or might be what you read in a book, or might be what you've heard from a pastor or something in the past, in my humble opinion, if you read the Bible well, if you look at the original context, if you look at who John said he was writing to and what sort of style he tells us that he is writing in, what you'll figure out really, really fast is that Revelation isn't some sort of crystal ball for us that tells us when World War III is going to happen, probably with Russia, you know, and who the Antichrist is going to be, which is probably whatever politician you hate the most in your mind, right? By the way, the word Antichrist isn't in Revelation. Not once, right? But it, you know, tells us who the Antichrist is. Okay, it tells us when the rapture is going to come. Rapture is not in Revelation either. Go read it for yourself. But it tells us all that, right? It tells us we're going to get a microchip in our arm. And if you take the microchip, you're going to hell. But if you don't take the microchip, you'll get your head cut off, you know, and get to go to heaven at least. But it'll hurt just for a second, right? No, that's not Revelation. That's not Revelation. No. Okay, and if that's what you think about Revelation, I would just humbly submit to you that it's not what you think. And to go back last week and listen online, because we laid out exactly to who it was written and exactly in what style it was written. Now, with that being said, I want to pick up where we left off last week, though. Because while we said that Revelation wasn't written to us, it was written for us. It's written for any generation and every generation of people. And if you have the eyes to see and the ears to hear what Revelation is saying to us, I think that you will discover a profound question at the core of it that will shake you from the inside out. Now, it's kind of a strange question, I'll admit. Okay, and if you don't think God's real and you don't think Jesus rose from the dead, then this question will sound like madness to you. So just chew on it and you know, hear us out. But at the end of the day, if you don't believe this stuff, you don't ever have to think about this question ever again. But if you do believe God is real, and you do believe that perhaps Jesus rose from the dead, then I would suggest to you, this is the most important question you will ever consider, even though most of us don't consider it on a day-to-day basis. Okay, here's the core question of Revelation. This is where we left off. What is your 10,000-year plan? Or 10 million for that matter. Or 10 billion. It's up to you. Just add however many zeros you want. What is it? What's your 10,000-year plan? Hey, it's 2018. Have you begun considering what you're going to be doing in 2018? Now, some of you are smiling, some of you are nodding, you know, your head and elbow, because you get it, right? You're like, Tyler, in 10,000 years, I will have died. True. Revelation agrees with that. You will have died, but Revelation would tell you that you won't be dead. In fact, you will be quite alive, and the nature of your existence then will be determined largely, in part, by the nature of your existence now. So have you begun thinking about 2018, ma'am, sir? Okay, so we're familiar with life planning, aren't we? You guys make life plans? Probably sometime in your mid to late 20s, early 30s, you started thinking about what you're going to do with your life. You started deciding, here's what my career is going to look like, and here's where I want to live, and I want to get married and have this many kids, you know, and this is the kind of house that I want. These are the things on my bucket list, and this is when I want to retire, and here's how comfortably I want to retire, right? You started writing all these things down, and the rest of your life was spent building and focusing that life plan. And that's not a bad thing. Those aren't bad questions. I would just suggest to you that most of us are answering those questions with the wrong end assumption. Right? You see, most of us answer those questions about our life plan with the assumption that death is the end. But Revelation says, what if it isn't? What if it's a door? What if it's a reckoning? What if it's just a new beginning? At last week at the end, I left with this diagram. And I don't know, for me personally, maybe it didn't resonate for you, but for me personally, this diagram helps me make sense of what John is trying to do in Revelation. Basically, once at a leadership conference, I heard a leader talk about making a plan for your organization, a strategic plan. And he said, before you develop your plan, you better clarify, get crystal clear on two things. First, before you make the plan. Okay. One is your vision for the future, and two is your current reality. Don't you make a plan until you understand the current reality of your business, of the health of your business, of the, you know, your competitors, of the marketplace. You better understand what's going on around you. If you make a plan without understanding reality, y'all, your plan will be out of touch with reality. So you better understand reality before you make your plan. And you better know exactly where you want to go, because if you make a plan without knowing where you want to go, then guess where you'll go? Who knows, right? Who knows? So you got to get really clear on these two points. And then once you're clear on it, then you can start carving out. Then you can start carving out your plan. Well, I would suggest to you that that is exactly what Revelation gives us. This right here. It gives us God's assessment of reality. What the world calls good versus what God calls good. What the world calls successful and hashtag blessed and the good life versus what God calls successful, blessed, and the good life. What the world calls great versus what God calls true greatness. And then it points us to God's vision for the future, and John walks on stage and says, all right, you got the 2 points. Now, which plan will you run? The 30-year plan or the 10,000-year plan? It's a good question, right? It's a good question. Now, this is going to be our construct for the next 3 weeks of our series, week 2, 3, and 4. We got a fifth week, but this is what we're going to break down. Okay, because again, it just makes sense to me. This week, we're going to look at God's vision for the future and get as clear as possible on that point as we can so that we can direct our 10,000-year plan toward it. Next week, we're going to come back. We're going to look at God's evaluation of current reality. For those of you who have read Revelation, this is what Revelation calls the mark of the beast versus the mark of the lamb. Some of you thought it was a microchip, not a microchip. I'd suggest to you that there are people in this room right now that got the mark of the lamb, and there are some people in this room right now that have the mark of the beast as we speak. And I know you want to know which one you are, right? Come back next week. Now, the fourth week after we establish these 2 points, we're going to do a performance eval of our 10,000-year plan. We're going to look at how our church is doing, how the church in America is doing. Did you know that in Revelation 2 and 3, Jesus actually gives a performance eval to the Revelation churches? There are 7 churches in Revelation that this letter is written to. And in chapters 2 and chapters 3, Jesus gives each of them a paragraph, a little letter, a little excerpt, telling these churches exactly what they need to start, exactly what they need to stop, exactly what's good about them, exactly what's bad about them, and what they need to do about it. It's fascinating. I'm going to pretend like Jesus wrote one to us in the fourth week. And some parts might make us feel really good, and some parts might challenge us really deep, but it's important. All right, so there's 2, 3, and 4. Are you excited? I'm excited about it. You might not be excited. I'm excited. All right, now, today, the Revelation vision of the future. You can find most of the content about what Revelation thinks about the future in the last 4 chapters of the book. But I think the most rich stuff falls in Revelation 21. And 22. Revelation 21 and 22 describe for us what we would call today heaven. Heaven. Okay, and let me ask you a question. This is an important question. Do y'all really want to end up in heaven? Like, really? Okay, you see, okay, back to our diagram. All right. If we want to end up in heaven, you would think that our 10,000-year plan, our life plan right now, would be pointed towards heaven and heavenly realities. Jesus once prayed in this iconic prayer. He said, here's how I want you guys to pray. Pray like this. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Jesus told us to pray that way. Or in other words, he told us to live that way. He told us to make heavenly realities real here on earth. Heavenly realities in our earthly lives, right? So, question for you. According to your life, Do y'all really want to go to heaven? Are these the kind of things you discuss with your financial advisor? Well, we really need a plan for 10,000 years from now. So let's start saving. or giving? Are these the kind of things you think about when you're making job and career decisions? You know, I just want to make the kingdom come, the kingdom come, the kingdom come. Are these the kind of things that determine how you raise your kids, like the values you instill in them, the way you help them prioritize their schedules? I just want to point them towards heaven. I want to point them towards heaven. I want to point them towards heaven. It's a worthwhile question to think through. Do we really? I know that we would say, yeah, I want to go to heaven, right? But do we really? We really want to go to heaven. Now, I'll tell you this. If heaven is like how our culture caricatures it, then I don't want to go to heaven. Me personally. I don't want to float up onto clouds with a halo and a harp and sing for the next billion years, right? I like to sing. Flying would be cool, maybe for 10 or 20 years, right? But at the end of the day, singing maybe 50 years from now might start getting a little bit old to me personally. Have you ever heard the last verse of Amazing Grace? You guys ever heard it? Okay, so you guys know Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Okay, so you know the tune. There you go. All right. Now, here's the last verse. Check this out. All right. And I'm sorry to ruin Amazing Grace for you. The first verse is great, but the last verse is terrifying for me. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. Than when we first begun. No, I'm kidding. Now, guys, come on. Have you ever thought about this? You know what Revelation asks us to envision? It asks us to envision that we've been in heaven for 10,000 years singing. For 10,000 years. Some of you guys can't make it through a four-song set. You're looking at your watch like it's been 20 minutes. Where's the preacher, right? How about a 10,000-year song set, right? For 10,000 years we've been singing, and then all of a sudden this realization comes over you. We've no less days. We haven't even got started. Now, that's terrifying for me, personally. And I like to sing, especially if I'm stuck in the heavenly choir next to some of y'all. Because some of y'all can't sing. That'd be hell, not heaven. So, I'm just saying, if heaven is the way that we're caricaturing in our culture, then I don't want to go there. But fortunately, Revelation 21 and 22 give us a much more beautiful vision of it. I want to read you some excerpts from these chapters. I'm going to use the Message paraphrase because I think it is so rich in the way Eugene Peterson describes it for us. Chapter 21, I saw heaven. Just imagine this with John, because that's what he wants you to do in Revelation, to imagine. I saw heaven and earth, new created, gone. The first heaven, gone the first earth, gone the sea. I saw holy Jerusalem, new created, descending, resplendent out of heaven, as ready for God as a bride for her husband. I heard a voice of thunder from the throne. Look, 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 look. God has moved into the neighborhood, making his home with men, with women. There is people. He's their God. He'll wipe every tear from their eyes. Death is gone for good. Tears, gone. Crying, gone. Pain, gone. All the first order of things, they gone. The enthroned continued. Look, 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 look. I'm making everything new. Write it down. Because each word is dependable and true. The city was shimmering. It just shimmered like a precious gem. Light-filled, pulsing light. The wall was jasper, the color of glory. And the city was pure gold, translucent. It's glass. The foundations of the city walls were garnished with every precious gem imaginable. The first foundation, jasper. Second, sapphire. Third, agate. Fourth, emerald. Fifth, onyx. Sixth, carnelian. Seventh, chrysolite. Eighth, beryl. Ninth, topaz. 10th and 11th, can't really pronounce them. 12th, amethyst. Oh, and check this out. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each gate was made out of a single pearl. That's crazy. And the main street of the city was pure gold, translucent as glass. But there was no sign of a temple, for the Lord God, the sovereign strong, and the Lamb are the temple. And the city doesn't need sun or moon for light, because God's glory is its light. The Lamb is its lamp. Nothing dirty or defiled will get in there. No one who defiles or deceives. Then the angel showed me water of life river, crystal black. It flowed from the throne of God and the Lamb, right down the middle of the street. And there's a tree of life planted on each side of the river, producing 12 kinds of fruit and a ripe fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree are for healing the nations. Never again will anything be cursed. The throne of God and the Lamb is at the center, and his servants will offer God's service. And they will rule with him age after age after age. Now, that's much better, at least in my humble opinion, than our culture's caricature of heaven. Is it not? But real talk. Let me ask you, y'all really want to end up there? Like really? Because see, maybe I could ask it to you just in a little bit of a different way, all right? If we actually want God's version of heaven so much, what are we waiting for? So I know what we're waiting for, right? We can't make it perfect, right? Of course we can't make it perfect. We can't make it heaven perfect. We can't make it Jesus perfect, right? But we can make it a little bit better. Look, me and you are imperfect. I get that. But should that stop us from pressing on towards better? Everywhere you go, there you are messing things up. I get it. That's called the human condition. But should that stop us from carving out a 10,000-year plan that pushes day in and day out toward the heavenly realities that we say we want? If this is what we want, what are we waiting for? Okay, you know how you know what someone really wants? Like what they really want. I'll tell you how you know. Their actions. Jesus says you can tell a tree by its fruit, right? In the same way, I would tell you today, actions validate desires. Actions validate the desires of someone's heart. You want to know what they want? Look at their lives. I'll give you an example. Right now, my son Palmer is 3.5 years old, and he is obsessed with Santa. Obsessed with him. Okay, now this past Christmas was the first Christmas he started to really be able to wrap his mind around, you know, Santa Claus and the presents and all that. And so he's just obsessed. Every night when I pray with him before bed, he thanks God for Santa. It's June. We read Maddie's Christmas Bear, or whatever it's called, 3 times this past week. It's June, all right? Dear God, thank you for Santa and Mommy, son. You know, like, and Mommy and Santa. You do know Jesus is more important than Santa. Anyways, these are the conversations going on in our house. Now, we'll try not to screw them up, but parents, those of you who are you know, kind of teaching your kids the Santa story, let me ask you, what do you tell your kids they must do if they want to prove to Santa that they truly desire what's on their Christmas wish list? They better be good. You better be a good boy. You better be a good girl, because he's making a list and he's checking it twice. Right? Just in case you think he missed you on the first round through, he's checking it twice. And he's going to find out who's naughty and who's nice. Now, you know what you're teaching your kids? You're teaching your kids that actions validate desires. Right? So if that's true, what do we really want? Do you really want heaven? Perhaps I could say it to you like this. If we want less sorrow, pain, tears, evil, sin, and death, as Revelation says, what are we waiting for? If we want less corruption and dishonesty, what are we waiting for? If we want more people to find healing and care, what are we waiting for? If we want a beautiful, shining, clean, and bright city, what are we waiting for? If we want God's intimate presence, what are we waiting for? Or if we really, truly want to serve God forever and ever and ever, what are we waiting for? Because yeah, we're imperfect, but these things don't gotta wait. Do they? Okay, here's what I'm gonna do. I wanna revisit Revelation 21 and 22, our excerpt there. What I wanna do is I just wanna pull out 3 attributes of heaven, characteristics of heaven then, that I don't believe we gotta wait on, that I believe that we could, to some degree, make more present today. And as we look at these three characteristics, I just want you to ask this question. If my actions really validate my desires, if actions validate desires, how actively do I desire heaven today, right now? Right, simple question. So here's the first attribute. First attribute of heaven. Heaven is a new city here on earth. Check this out, 21:1. John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the old heaven and the old earth had disappeared, and the sea was gone. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming where? Down. It's coming down to us from God out of heaven like a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, look, God's home is where? Well, it's now among his people, like it's here among us. He'll live with them. They'll be his people. God himself will be with him. And then the one sitting on the throne said, look, I'm making everything new. Now, the Revelation 21 vision of heaven, in the end, is not somewhere that we go, is it? Rather, it's somewhere that comes to us. It descends down. God's here, and the heavens and earth are made new. Now, the key word here is new, right? What does this word new even mean? Well, in the ancient Greek language, there were two Greek words for new underneath our one English word new. And it's important to understand the subtle difference because it helps us get to the bottom of the passage. There's naos new and kainos new. Naos new and kainos new. Now, naos new points to quantitative newness. Quantitative. Like numerical. Naos new is like something that's newly born or newly created. It's a baby one day old. It's a 2018, you know, model car that has 0 miles driven on it. Fresh off the assembly line, right? It's brand spanking new. That's naos new. A quantitative value to it. You with me? Now, kainos new is slightly different, though, because it points to a qualitative newness. It's not necessarily something that's just been created, but it's something that's been renewed, if you will, resurrected. Maybe this metaphor will help. Let's imagine that you find this house, this old beaten-down house, but it has a lot of character to it. And so you decide to make it like new. That's kainos new, right? You decide to go all Chip and Joanna on it, right? And you just, poof, you know, you make it shine once again. That's kainos. Now, you get the difference between naos and kainos? All right. Now, which Greek word do you think is being used here in Revelation 21? Naos or kainos? It's actually kainos new. Kainos new. To steal our metaphor, basically Jesus shows up here on earth on this old plot of land with this old house sitting on it. That's been decaying and deteriorating for thousands upon thousands of years because of evil, death, and sin. And he just breathes fresh life into it, restores it to its original state, better than its original state. He sows fresh grass in the yard, plants a garden in the back, hangs a hammock on the back porch, a swing on the front. Goes in, puts a fresh coat of paint on the walls, new floors, new light fixtures. New countertops and appliances in the kitchen. Like, I mean, he just brings the thing back to life. Like we never could have imagined it coming to life. That's heaven. It's kainos new. Qualitatively better. A qualitatively better world. Now, question for you, question though. If that is in fact true, if heaven is a qualitatively better world, then this right here and right now, what are we waiting for? If heaven is a place where Jesus brings life into that which is decaying and dying and being destroyed by sin and death and evil and pain, what are we waiting for? Okay, actions validate our desires, right? So do we really want to end up in heaven? Really? Because what are we waiting for? Here's the second attribute of heaven. Heaven's like a paradisiacal garden, right? It's almost like Eden. He draws all these metaphors and images from the natural world in order to paint a picture for us, doesn't he? You read this with me, 21:18. The wall was made of jasper. The city pure gold, as clear as glass. The wall was built on foundation stones inlaid with every kind of precious stone you could imagine. Down to the last line, the 12 gates were made of pearls, each gate from a single pearl. And the main street was pure gold, as clear as glass. And the city had no need for sun or moon, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb was its light. And then the angel showed me a river That was the water of life. It was clear as crystal. It was flowing from the throne of God and the Lamb. It flowed down the center of the street. The tree of life was on both sides of it, bearing fresh fruit every single month. And the leaves were used as medicine. And check out that last line. No longer will there be a curse. Not just on anyone, but anything. The whole thing. All the heavens and earth and the people and organic life on it are made new. Now, when I was reading this passage a couple years ago, I was having a hard time visualizing. Again, that's what John wants you to do. He wants you to visualize these images he paints. I was having a hard time visualizing the city. So you know what I did? I went online and I Googled. Because, you know, you can trust everything on the internet, right? So I Googled the most beautiful places in the world. And then I just started going through pictures and asking myself, what pictures look like this passage right here? Anything remind me of it? First picture I came across were the Rainbow Mountains of Peru. And when John says that the walls of the city are inlaid with every kind of precious gem, just luminous, dazzling colors, I don't know what that would look like. But maybe it looks something like that. No Photoshop there, y'all. This next picture is a picture of the Grand Prismatic Spring in Yellowstone National Park, largest natural spring in the United States of America. And as I think about the old giving way to the new, like the sun peeking over the horizon and chasing darkness off the landscape, I don't know what that looked like. But maybe something like that. This is a picture of the Northern Lights from Iceland. And when I think about there being no sun, no moon, just the Lamb and God illuminating everything, I honestly don't know what that will look like. But maybe it'll look something like that. I mean, the whole thing's just this beautiful garden. A clear river running down the middle. Fresh fruit, trees, leaves that heal. It's the natural world that we've been given at its finest. Now, question for you though, question. If that is in fact true, if heaven explodes with the diverse glories of our beautiful earth that God created, do you really want to end up there? Do you really? Now, a lot of you are like, well, yeah, of course I want to end up there. Yeah, of course I want to end up there. But you know what I found for me? I found that more often than not, I don't end up out there. I end up in an office. I end up with my face to a screen rather than my face to the face of God that he has painted on the beautiful world around us. Do we really want to end up there, y'all? Do we really want a bright and shining and beautiful earth? Or do we want to consume it and materialize it and pollute it? I know I'm going green on you for a second, but let me just talk for a second. Did you know that the average American consumes 30 times more than the average person from India? Did you know that in the last 50 years, we have consumed more in the United States of America than the entire population of the planet Earth before the last 50 years? So if this is what we want, a beautiful world, and actions validate desires, my question is, do we really want to end up there? Really? Last attribute of heaven. According to Revelation, is the full presence of our God who is love. 22:3. No longer will there be a curse upon anything, for the throne of God and the Lamb will be there, and his servants will worship him. And don't miss this line. They will see his face. They'll see his face. And isn't that what frustrates you about God sometimes? This is what frustrates me about God. I can't see him. I can't touch him more often than not. I'm just not feeling him, right? My friends are like, I heard God speak to me. I've never heard God in an audible voice speak to me. And sometimes I just want that, right? Like he spoke to people in the Bible, so I know he can do it. He spoke through a donkey once. He wrote on a wall with his finger. I'm like, God, here's a dry erase marker right on the whiteboard. Please, right? Give me a dream. Give me a vision. Don't send an angel, because when you send angels, people freak out, right? But a dream, a vision, whatever. Knock a book off the desk. I don't know. Turn my Bible to a page, as I've heard some people say. Like, just give me something so that I can experience your presence. Hey, in my moments of greater doubt, where I feel like God is distant, this is the verse I turn to, because I'm just reminded one day I'll see him face to face. 21:4. Next slide. John writes, he'll wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, sorrow, crying, or pain. Those things are gone forever. Nothing evil will be allowed to enter the city, nor anyone who worships anything else other than God, right? Dishonesty won't be allowed in the city. Only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Now, the logic behind these two verses right here is that there are certain things that just don't belong in the presence of God, and so they won't be in heaven because God's full presence will be there. They just won't be allowed. According to the scriptures, we serve a God who is love. The greatest revelation of God was Jesus on the cross. Self-sacrificial love, right? Plus the scriptures just straight up say it, 1 John 4, God is love. So the idea here is whatever the antithesis of love is, that will not be in heaven, because in heaven, love is the atmosphere. In heaven, love is the material from which the cosmos will be made. We'll breathe it in and breathe it out. I can't wait for that. Not just to experience that with God, but to experience that with y'all. See, come on, you think we love each other right now? We don't love each other. Even your most intimate relationship, there are things in between you and them, like ego, like shame, like pride, like suspicion, like scars and regret from your past that keep you apart, like prejudice, that pull you apart. Okay, think of the most intimate relationship in your life right now. Just think of it. If revelation is true, that relationship is just a clogged pipe spurting out muddy water compared to the way love will freely flow between us in heaven. These things are gone. Maybe the most shocking thing John says about heaven here in this clip is what he says in 21:22. At least to his original audience. He said, I saw no temple in the city. For the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. No temple. When he said that, the people in the audience would have been like sipping their coffee and like, what? What? No temple? Because every city had a temple back then. Every city had temples. All seven of our Revelation cities had cultic sites in them. Six of them had temples to the emperor. Five of them had taxpayer-subsidized priesthoods that would offer sacrifices to the emperor day in and day out on behalf of the people of the city. Ephesus, one of our Revelation cities, had the largest pagan temple on the planet Earth at the time in the city. It was to the goddess Diana, Artemis. You can read about Paul's experience with that crew in Acts. It's kind of crazy, right? This temple was massive, one of the seven wonders of the world, 420 feet long. Think about that. 220 feet wide, 60 feet high, and then 127 pillars in the temple. It's four times bigger than the Parthenon in Athens. These cities had temples. Let us not forget Jerusalem. Jerusalem had a temple. The Jews believed that in that temple, in the Holy of Holies, it was the place where heaven and earth met, where God's presence literally dwelt. And so they would pilgrimage there from all over the world in order to experience the presence of God. But hey, no more pilgrimages. No more having to go to a building to experience God's presence when revelation falls. No, it'll be everywhere. His presence will be unavoidable. He'll be in the neighborhood, right? Now, if that is in fact true, I have another question for you. If heaven is the unavoidable presence of God, do we really want to end up there? Like, really? Or maybe I could say it like this. How's your prayer life? Because that's one avenue, one channel God has dug for us today to be intimate with him. So actions validate desires. Do you really want to be intimate? Like, how's your prayer life? My prayer life can be kind of shoddy sometimes. And I justify it by saying, well, I'm more of a Bible reader than a prayer. But hey, check this out. If prayer is just communicating with God, there will not be an option to be more of a Bible reader than a prayer one day in heaven. How about this one? Jesus once said, when two or more are gathered in my name, there I am. There's God's presence right there. Okay, there's another channel God has dug today for us to access his intimate presence. But do you gather regularly? Not just on weekends, but throughout the week with brothers and sisters in Christ? Oh, how about this one? Jesus said once, you can't serve two masters. Well, can I kind of? No, cannot. What do you mean by cannot, Jesus? It's impossible, okay? You can't serve two masters. You can't serve both God and money. In other words, you can only be intimate with one. You can only wrap your arms around one. You can only embrace one. Which do you embrace? Do we really want to end up in heaven? I'll say it in a slightly different way. If in heaven, love is the only option, what are we waiting for? What are we waiting for? You know, that's why here at Northeast, we call ourselves the Love the Ville Church. We want to become the Love the Ville Church. We want to make it DNA. It's not just something that we do. It's who we are. You see it when you walk out those two doors every single week, right? See, okay, you know what I think? I think some people think that Love the Ville is like a catchy slogan. It's marketing. I think some people think it's just like a few projects we do during the summer. I think some folks think it's just like an outreach program or something. But man, do you ever have it wrong. Love the Ville is not a program. It's a path to heaven. It's a 10,000-year plan. It's a lifestyle. It's a commitment to bond heaven and earth in this family and body right here. It's a declaration to the world that heaven is real and heaven is better and heaven is coming, but we cannot wait and we will not wait because we're just too excited. But if actions validate desires, is heaven what we really want? You know what I love? I love when God gives us a glimpse of heaven on earth. We get them here at the Love the Ville Church all the time. If you just open your eyes and watch. Two weeks ago, I got this beautiful glimpse of heaven meeting earth. It was through my friend Mandela. Who was here on Global Outreach Weekend when Mandela, our refugee friend, came up on stage and I got a chance to interview him? So several of you, right? Mandela is a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He came to America 15 months ago with his family of 12 after spending 10 years. That would be 10 with a T. 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 10. 10 years in a refugee camp. And over the course of the next 15 months, because we helped get some of those barriers of entry out of the way for him, he flourished as a man. Learned English in 15, like in 3 months, he learned English. Which, by the way, he already knew 6 languages, right? So adding a 7th, big deal. You know, in America, we speak 1, American, right? American, that's what we speak here. He speaks 7, he's learned it just like that. He's got 2 jobs now, 1 at the Omni Hotel, 1 translating English for other refugees. He's enrolled at JCTC, taking college classes, and he'll be a citizen within 18 months, right? Like, he has just flourished. And it was fun getting to hear what God's doing in his life. Now, the first service he did with us, though, when we interviewed him, was our Saturday night service. And so after the service was over with, I grabbed him. I was like, hey, man, what'd you think about our church and our service in here? And he's like, well, it's different. It's different. I was like, well, you mean different? Different how? And he said, first off, your service and your sermons are really, really short. And I was like, praise God, let's give this dude a mic tomorrow, right? Okay? But like, he's like, in the Congo, we would have service for 4 hours on Sundays. And then he said, also, second, the music is different. And I was like, well, did you like it? And he goes, I really liked it. So you know what I decided to do? The next day at the 9 a.m. service, which is the next service we were doing together, I decided I was going to sit right there on that front row with him and watch him take in our service. Just want to watch. And for the first 15 minutes of the service, he was stiff as a board, just standing there, hands at his side. You could tell he was kind of looking around, again, absorbing it all, absorbing all the lights and the graphics and the Jesus smoke, right? Which, by the way, we don't have smoke machines. It just shows up, right? This is a Jesus, smoke. And he's like standing there looking around. And then we sang this lyric of one of the familiar songs that we sing all the time here. You'll probably recognize it. I've seen you move the mountains, and I believe I'll see you do it again. You made a way where there was no way, and I believe I'll see you do it again. Right, and you keep singing it, right? We keep singing it over and over. And as we sang that lyric, I watched Mandela move. For the first time that service, he closed his eyes, he bowed his head, and he just lifted his hands just a little bit. And I took a mental snapshot of the moment because I'm like, heaven and earth is meeting right now in front of my eyes. Because that lyric's real to him, right? Like he'd seen God move mountains just 15 months ago. It's real. And I just felt this overwhelming sense of gratitude that we got to be a part of that, right? Like we got to pronounce over our brother in Christ, there will be no more curse on this family right here, right? All these things are gone forever. No more civil war, no more refugee camp, no more poverty, no more fearing for your life, no just new life here with us. Man, I love it. Keep your eyes open because God will give you a glimpse of heaven, and I just love it when he does. So you know what I've been praying personally this week in light of this message? Just a really, really practical prayer to help me reframe the way that I think about my heaven, about my everyday life, keeping heaven in mind. This is what I've been praying. God, today, in at least one way, just let me prove heaven is where I'm heading. And you know what I pray? I pray that you would pray this with me this week, and then you do something about it. Will you repeat this after me if this is truly in your heart? Say, God, today, in at least one way, let me prove heaven is where I'm heading. I can think of no church like Love the Ville Church that makes opportunities available for you to do this. We threw this graphic up on social media about a week ago. It's got all sorts of stuff coming up that's both off campus in the city, but also on campus, because Love the Ville isn't just loving out there, it's loving in here too. And I would encourage you, this is not a commercial, I would just encourage you to get involved in one of these simple opportunities, because those are not mundane, that's heaven. That's where heaven meets earth, right there. Now, I want to close with this, a thought experiment, if you will. Why don't you just think with me? Right, and pretend, just imagine, pretend, that only the top 100 Christians got into heaven. Top 100. All right, now that's not how it works, for the record. All right, you don't get into heaven based on what you do. You get into heaven based on what Jesus has done for you. Jesus' people, right? But let's just pretend it is how it works, just for a second. And only the top 100 get in. All right, now I want you to think in your mind right now of somebody that you think would get in. All right, just think in your mind a name, a face. It could be somebody you know. Could be a historic, you know, figure in the history of Christianity. I don't know, just think. All right, has anybody got one? Somebody yell one out. Mother Teresa. Who else? Billy Graham, right? Because, I mean, Mother Teresa served thousands of the least of these on the other side of the world. Billy Graham spent his life literally telling millions upon millions upon millions of people about Jesus. So they probably aren't the top 100. They're top 50. Somebody said Bob Cherry last service, and I was like, okay. But Billy Graham, Mother Teresa, they're in. They're in, right? Now, here's the question, though. If we know they're in heaven, and heaven is what we really want, then why wouldn't we just throw everything down today and become as much like them as possible? I'm not asking you to move to Indonesia. I'm not telling you to go to, you know, Great American Ballpark and try to preach a sermon in front of 50,000 today, all right? Because they probably won't listen. But in your everyday context, why not just throw everything down and say, I'm going to imitate them as they imitate Jesus? If they're in and we want to be in, why not? Well, Tyler, you know, it's just not practical for all of us to be Mother Teresa's. How do you know? I've never seen a group try before. Well, Tyler, I got kids. I'm trying to raise my kids instead of the other, so I can't pull away. Wait, hold on, time out. As a Christian parent, what is your number one goal? Right, to point your kids toward Jesus. Point them towards the heavenly realities, right? Well, Tyler, we can't be Billy Graham, right? Because Billy Graham, he was especially gifted. Mother Teresa, she was special. No, she wasn't. She wasn't special. She was faithful. She wasn't special. She was just willing. She wasn't special. She was a sinner just like all of us. You know what I found when I read the Bible and I read stories about people who profoundly changed the world? They're not all that special. They're just available. They're willing. You ever heard Moses' story? How about David's? How about Jonah? He was a screw up, right? How about Peter? How about the Apostle Paul, right? These first folks were only as special as they were available. And here's what I know about you. You can be available if you want. So do you really want? Do we really want? Go to heaven, y'all. Do we really? If it is, if you do, I just want, will you close and just, again, repeat this prayer after me. And then let's go live it. Say, God, today, in at least one way, let me prove heaven is where I'm heading. In Jesus' name, amen. Hey, don't miss next week as we define the current reality, God's assessment of current reality, and continue our series. Thank you so much for being here. Have an awesome week.